You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Whether you're savoring your victories in last night's election, licking your wounds, or perhaps a bit of both, this week, Your Legal Rights considers the vote, voting glitches and monopolies, open source software. Tonight, we welcome Brent Turner, Secretary of the California Association of Voting Officials. If you have questions for my guest, our phone number to us in the studio is 415-841-4134, 415-841-4134, or if you're outside of the San Francisco area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. It's November 7th, 2018, the night after the election. We're discussing elections, monopolies, and open source election software. What's wrong with the current system? Is it vulnerable to hacking, software glitches? A 2006 movie suggested we vote in a talk show host, not because he swayed folks in certain parts of the country, but because the structure of his name fed into a software glitch. Is there really such a danger as we sit here today? For the first time since I've been here, my guest in the studio tonight is not a practicing attorney. Mr. Turner is a graduate of Lincoln Law School in San Francisco and has a degree granted by the University of San Diego in International Legal Studies from Oxford, England. Mr. Turner is a community activist whose efforts include volunteer work for the homeless, children's health and education, civil rights, and environmental issues. Mr. Turner was instrumental in the creation of the San Francisco County Voting Systems Task Force and has been a director of communications for Open Voting Consortium. Brent has been recognized as a groundbreaking activist for sustainability and dedicates himself to local, state, and federal issues. Brent, let me welcome you to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you, Jeff. Good to be here.
Again, our phone number in the studio is 415-841-4134. 415-841-4134. Or if you're calling from outside of the San Francisco area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. Brent, welcome. And I'd like to start here. Let's start with telling us about why would anyone want to look into elections and the machinery and really get involved to where they dissect the crumb? How did you really get so involved?
Bad luck. A curiosity when 2000 hit and we couldn't get a proper vote count coming out of the Bush v. Gore election. It stoked my curiosity, and I went looking for the answer why we don't have more functional elections in the United States. That led me to get involved, and a few years later, of course, we transitioned toward the electronic voting systems, which brought into the conversation a brand new element, which is the technology, rather than just the paper that resulted in the hanging Chad incident of Bush v. Gore. Now we were faced with these technology issues, including the software. So I started associating with some groups that had good concept and were moving toward demonstrating proper systems that had transparency with an element called open source software that really has turned out to be fundamental to a proper system.
Now, before we move on to some of these organizations and what they're doing and really what their positions are, you had mentioned the year 2000, but aren't you rather infamous for calling for a recount of the 2016 election?
I am infamous for a few different reasons in a few different circles, but I think you're alluding to the fact that we did take a writ to the Supreme Court and asked for to be recognized. The writ was not recognized, and that was unfortunate because the idea was to quash the results of the 2016 election based on outside interference and do a revote. And of course, right at the time when we were pushing for that and also notifying the secretaries of states throughout the country that they should not be certifying the results based on the technology issues inherent to the current systems, we like I said, we weren't successful in that, but it did prove up to be a good strategy because as we've seen, once the genie's out of the bottle, it's very hard to put it back in.
We've heard of late the president speak about voter fraud, and others speak about election fraud. What's the difference?
Well, with voter fraud, you're speaking when Trump alludes to voter fraud, he's talking about an event where a voter would go into a precinct, purport to be someone they weren't, impersonate somebody, and cast a vote illegally. That really doesn't happen too much, in our opinion. That would be a rarity. When we talk about election fraud, that is the act of some force manipulating an election or the election results. So we differentiate election fraud from voter fraud that way.
So interestingly, when we're looking, for example, at the 2016 election, one side might be complaining about voter fraud. The other side might be complaining about election fraud.
Correct.
Are either one of these widespread?
Well, with voter fraud, we don't see too much evidence of voter fraud, although it could occur. That wouldn't be the wholesale event that the election fraud issue would be, where a voter fraud incident would affect one single vote. An election fraud incident could affect thousands or tens of thousands of vote, or change an election from one result to another, whereas a single act of voter fraud would just affect that one vote. I think they both likely occur, and it's just a matter of to what degree. We don't see it so much with single voters impersonating people, but we are very concerned about the software that's running the current systems and the potential for manipulation of election results.
Tell me about the San Francisco's Voting System Task Force.
That was put together years back, championed by myself, working with Supervisors Tom Amiano and Chris Daly, who stood up for the position that corporations should not be in control of the election systems and the software should be transparent and available to the general public. So we started the task force, and it was put together. Some good people, a fellow Kai Ping Yi was on it, Tim Mayer, who's now president of the California Association of Voting Officials, was on it, and they came to the conclusion that we at Open Voting Consortium, then to morph toward California Association of Voting Officials, had the right strategy, which is to open the systems up to general public license software, open source software, and have a simple architecture with a paper ballot system, printers, tablets, very low-cost, off-the-shelf approach. That would really change the dynamic and basically remove the vendors from the security chain of custody. And that's a major element of this. It turns out the vendors are carrying with them a lot of the security breaches and vulnerabilities.
Tell me a bit about the California Association of Voting Officials.
The California Association of Voting Officials, or CAVO, was put together as a vehicle to encourage the pooling of resources by counties. It became apparent at a certain point that the feds nor the states were going to properly fund our work toward these open source public voting systems. So at that point, we wanted to have a fallback position, which would be that the counties themselves would pool their resources and move California or whatever state they were located in toward these better systems. So that is something that is still occurring now. We are encouraging these counties to join San Francisco's project. San Francisco has allocated a couple million dollars to get their voting system project started, and they're currently interested in speaking to other counties that feel they're caught in this vendor trap of overpriced voting machines that lack appropriate security.
And tell me about the Open Voting Consortium.
Open Voting Consortium is Alan Deckert. He's known as the father of the open source voting movement. They did the initial, all the heavy lifting around this particular issue by pioneering the architecture and the concepts. They put together a consortium of a few hundred top worldwide scientists from all different countries, and there was a lot of thought that went into basically troubleshooting these systems so that, the best minds could get together, try to analyze what a criminal would do if they were trying to break the system, and then put in proper redundancies and defense to those sorts of shenanigans. So Open Voting Consortium is historic as the initiation of this work.
What do you mean by open source voting systems?
Well, when we say open source, we mean software that is fully available to the public for inspection. So it's to be differentiated from closed software or privatized software that currently runs the voting systems. There was a case in Florida, the Jennings case, where Christine Jennings felt that she was not being treated fairly with the results of a race she ran, and she didn't trust the results. So she asked to see the software that was running the systems, and the court denied her that ability. They said she could not subpoena the code because it was the intellectual property of the vendor that was making the system. So that's the privatized version. The open source version is software that cannot be sold. It is a free software that belongs to the public, and it has the benefits of maybe you and I aren't adept enough to take a look and see if there's bugs in it, but any competent programmer or coder could take a look and see that there were bugs in the software, and then those could be addressed. So the transparency provides a upgrade to the security environment in that now you know what's going on with the software. Currently, the systems are such that we do not.
And how does open source software drive innovation?
I think that there is an ability for upgrade, spontaneous upgrade, when you have a lot of people with their eyes on the code and a lot of smart people that wish to participate in this pursuit of democracy. They're available to give real-time recommendations, and you would not enjoy that environment with a Microsoft code or code that is vendor-created.
You've talked a bit about vendors. How many vendors are there?
Currently, there's three that really control the market. There's ESNS, there is Dominion, and there is a group out of Texas called Heart Inner Civic that currently is in Orange County, California, as well as San Mateo County. And there's more, but those are the big three, with Dominion and ESNS controlling the lion's share of the market. That in itself is problematic because, simple antitrust issues come to mind, but also the fact that you've got vendor lock-in occurring at the county levels, so that the folks that are making the choices regarding procurement are relegated to just a couple companies that are very much taking advantage of that situation.
So with merely three, it's pretty obvious that you've got near monopoly control. Does this, in your mind, affect outcomes?
Well, the very nature of the systems defies inspection. So as far as finding a smoking gun, let's say take the 2016 election that you referenced, there was that thought that in Michigan or some of these swing states, it would be ideal to have a forensic analysis of the systems. And we fought for that forensic analysis, although it never occurred. That would be the one way that you could really take a look, and in the words of Brian Fox, one of our technologists that we rely upon at the National Association of Voting Officials and California Association, is that even if they didn't see direct hack evidence. They would see, in layperson's terms, the bleach used to cover up the murder. So there would be some crumbs left behind, something to show that somebody had been there. And that is the one way to really get into the analysis, the forensic analysis. Unfortunately, that doesn't occur in the real world. So you basically, when you go to investigate, you hit a brick wall that relates back to the proprietary nature of the software.
So I see a call is working its way to us. Eventually it'll find its way. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. This week, Your Legal Rights considers the vote, voting glitches, and monopolies, open source voting software, with Brent Turner, the Secretary of the California Association of Voting Officials. If you have questions for my guest, our phone number here in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or if you're calling from outside of the San Francisco area, call us toll-free. Our toll-free number is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Lisa from San Francisco, you are on Your Legal Rights. Welcome.
Hi, how are you? I'm trying to forward an article to you guys, but the email address I was given doesn't seem to work. It's an article written by Jennifer Cohn that I just ran across on Twitter today, talking about the Diebold systems and how the proprietary situation and basically incredible corruption has gone on since the onset of the use of paperless voting machines. And part of it is showing itself in what happened in Georgia. There was a lot of reports throughout the country of actual switching of votes while people were actually trying to use those machines. My question has to do, that's a comment regarding Diebold systems, and my question has to do with how do you think we would be able to go back to systems that actually have paper receipts, a paper trail, given the level of corruption and also the Secretary of State, Kemp. How normal it is such blatant corruption that the person in charge of voters and the whole voting system is actually running for governor and participating in this kind of basically voter fraud and voter suppression. So I'm wondering, how is there any precedent, legal precedent for that for this situation?
Well, Lisa, let me tell you, before I turn it over to Brent to answer your question, which is, you know, fairly complex, I'm wondering if you might be a little clairvoyant. If you could look at my crib notes, my very next topic was exactly on Georgia Secretary of State Kemp and what his claims were. So it seems like you and I have some kind of a mind meld going. But before we get there, are you familiar with the article, Brent, that Lisa was referring to?
I am familiar, Lisa, and you mentioned a couple of things that we should address. First of all, when we talk about proper systems, we want to talk in terms of a paper ballot system. So we want to differentiate that from a paper trail or a paper receipt. We want to make sure that any paper that's involved is in the actual form of a legal ballot. And that ballot, in our opinion, and there is a difference of opinion in the community on this, should not be hand-marked. So in other words, we want the voter experience to be, you go to the polling place, you encounter the first printing system, and on a screen it says, make your choice, George Washington or George Bush for president. You pick George Washington, and a ballot is dispensed that says very clearly your presidential choice, written out, spelled out in language, is George Washington. That is indisputable and eliminates voter intent issues, which we discussed in the context of Bush v. Gore with the hanging chads. The elimination of voter intent issues is crucial. So at that point, we've eliminated that issue. You also mentioned the need for a paper ballot, which we stipulate that is correct. A paper ballot is ideal. But we also want to make sure that when we talk about the need for paper ballot, we're always coupling it within the conversation with the absolute need for open source software as well. Because the reality is, and this was explained in an article I wrote with former CIA Director Jim Woolsey that the San Francisco Examiner put forward, and that is that if you have a paper ballot but you do not have proper software, since the first count that is announced to the media and posted comes from the software. It's actually coming from the process of the paper ballot being scanned through an intellectual property software system, and then a number is spit out. That number has to come from an open source software program, because if not, even though you've got the benefit of the ballot being scanned through the system, you could still be fooled by the bad software. So anytime we talk about these systems, we talk about them in terms of open source software, paper ballot systems, and there is a propensity, unfortunately, within the activist arena to only chant about the need for paper ballots, and they leave out the software component. We have technology. We have to acknowledge that and attack it rather than ignore it. So that is just something I wanted to mention in response to your question.
Thank you.
Lisa, thank you for joining us. I hope that was of some help. And if you listen tonight, you'll hear some more talk about the Georgia situation. It's coming up pretty quickly. But first, I turn to Armand in San Francisco. You're on your legal rights. Welcome.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. My idea is to get rid of the voting booth altogether, send out ballots that are mailed in, and at the headquarters, the ballots are scanned to a computer that is not attached or is not online. So you have the computers you need to, get the information, but it is not online. And this, I think Washington or someone up there has gotten rid of the whole thing as saving piles of money by just sending everyone an absentee ballot.
Armand,
I'm wondering why we can't do that.
Armand, you may have tapped into something. There is a pilot project I'm going to ask Brent about that is taking place right now. Four counties within California, including San Mateo County, your neighbor to the south, have started a project where they do exactly that. It's all absentee. Now, they do open voting centers a couple days before the election, but overwhelmingly, everyone, they don't have all of the precincts open that they used to. They're much smaller than they used to be. And overwhelmingly, everyone is pushed into absentee ballots. And I will ask Brent, do you think that's a good idea? And do you think there's a better way to accomplish that? Or is that really where we want to go?
I don't. And I appreciate Assemblymember Kevin Mullen and his work in this area. But I disagree with Kevin. And I disagree with that approach. I think the issue is that the closing down of precincts tends to disenfranchise communities of color. And so we have to be very sensitive when we take away voters' options. We have to be very sensitive when doing that. And, of course, the history of Jim Crow and everything else teaches us that more is better, less is worse. So if they were to add voting centers to the precincts that were already in existence, that wouldn't be such a bother. But when the precincts are removed, this creates a veritable poll tax. In San Mateo County, we did see that they allowed the free bus transportation during the election period, which was okay, but we've had reports from all over San Mateo County that people were very displeased and chose not to vote just because it was not as convenient for them and they had been used to going to their precincts. Understand, Armand, that Even if you do mail in your ballot, which of course has another security element attached, which is the postal service, but let's say you make it past the postman and now you have achieved your ballot being at the counting headquarters, at that point your ballot is still scanned through the privatized software systems that we mentioned, and so there is still the need for public software and the same architecture that we mentioned previous with the counting of the vote.
Wait a minute. You didn't get it. There wouldn't be outside computers scanning it. It would be a system that was transparent, and it would not be connected to the any computer that's going outside.
No,
votes by mail. Everybody gets their vote counted, and that strikes me as a hell of a lot safer and easier and a lot less expensive.
Well, if you're proposing counting by hand and eliminating the technology altogether and scrapping the computerized systems, I'd say go to your representative or your registrar and propose that they eliminate all technology from the counting process. I think you'll find that that's not going to happen realistically. So it would be a good idea to really attack the technology that they're using, and that's why we state very clearly. We advocate for the use of an open, transparent technology in the software. Eliminating the software completely, we found to be a non-starter politically, although some people do believe that one day we will hand count paper ballots in the United States. We don't see that as ever becoming a reality, so we work in our direction. But I appreciate your sentiment that would be better. I will remind you that even with hand counting, like they do in certain countries, they have far less volume that we have in the United States. And with hand counting, there are other issues attached, fatigue and error, human error, that with the redundancy of a proper open source system, we think it's an upgrade. You can hand count at the precinct level within our advised system, but that would actually be the third count, and that should happen. If you're going to hand count, it should happen at the precinct level. What you're talking about with all mail-in results in a central tabulation, which there's a security concern there. If you're doing it all in one batch, it's really harder to get a tight count that you might enjoy when they're broken into smaller batches at the precinct level.
I'm talking about them being scanned, but not and the computer is taking the count, but it's a count that has not been defiled by people, playing around with it, because there is nothing being connected to an outside computer. It all comes in, it all is counted by the same machine that has any.
What Armand's asking about is the feasibility of having the elections tabulated in a computer, perhaps a supercomputer, but that's not connected via the internet or any other networking software outside that voting center. Did I get that right, Armand?
That's absolutely right.
That's right. So that's how we have it today. That's how it currently is working in the United States. There should be no online aspect of the tabulation computers currently, but they still do suffer from the fact that the software is privatized. So even if they are properly offline, as Armand suggests, the issue then becomes, can we oversee what's going on inside that tabulation process? And currently we cannot. With proper systems like San Francisco is pioneering, we will be able to. So thank you for your question.
You still haven't got it.
Armand, I'm going to have to interrupt for a moment because we're at the bottom of the hour. I need to break for just a moment, and I'll come back to you. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW-FM 91.7 in San Francisco. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
Brent, Armand brought up a point about having them all done centrally, having all of the votes sent to a central location. Wasn't it in San Francisco not that many years ago when they found a discarded bag full of thousands of ballots in the vicinity of Candlestick Point?
Ballots in the Bay, the famous ballots in the Bay, yes. Anytime that you have a mail-in situation, you know, you're going to run that risk. And, of course, this is all about risk management. Certainly, we don't want any computers being left online, so that you know there can be that that affectation. And there are certainly good registrars throughout the state and the country that are aware and making sure those precautions are in place.
Armand, I see that we lost you at the bottom of the hour, but thank you for joining us. I hope we answered your questions. Howard from San Jose, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, guys. I've been following the election season and all this talk about voting fraud and making sure we know who is voting or how that everybody who is registering to vote is getting voted is always a perennial problem for some reason. And I keep hearing people saying, like, well, this wouldn't be a problem if we made it a requirement for everyone to vote, because that would create a mandate for the government to have a more system that works out to get everybody registered. And I was wondering if you guys might talk about the logistics of making a law that would force everybody to vote, because that seems like a really big ask, as nice as it may be.
Howard, that's an interesting question. One thing that comes to mind when you ask that is there are some religions, I don't think I'll delineate any in particular, one comes to mind to me, where they don't believe that you participate in governments here on earth, because the real government is after events happen where you have government coming down from the heavens, and you should not be participating in governments on earth. So to require them to vote, it seems to me, would interfere with the free exercise of their religion.
What religion is that, Jeff? I think I might be interested.
Right. Brent is trying to get me in trouble here. Actually, I've learned that as a tenet of the Jehovah's Witnesses, and those that are truly devout don't participate in man's government. But that being said,
smart.
How do you feel about Howard's question? Do you think logistically we could compel people to vote?
I think they do that in Australia by either a penalty or some sort of a benefit that accrues to the voter that actually does vote. I think in California, that would be very problematic, and across the United States, I don't see that happening. But what I do think would be wise is an opt-out mechanism whereby everybody that was a citizen with a social security number would automatically be registered and able to vote, and they would opt out if they were not interested, and everybody would just be automatically included. That seems to be a way to go. These registration issues are pervasive across the country. We can remedy them simply. Again, there are problems with vendors and database management systems. Most of them are proprietary in nature, and we're looking to make sure that there is open source public software and public systems from the very beginning of the process, the registration process, through to the end of the tabulation process.
Howard, I hope that answered your question. Thank you for joining us on Your Legal Rights.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. This week, Your Legal Rights considers the vote, voting glitches, and monopolies, and open source software with Brent Turner, the Secretary of the California Association of Voting Officials. That's www.cavo-us.org. If you have questions for my guest, our phone number here in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. If you're calling from outside of the San Francisco area, call toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. We've been talking about structural and organizational issues. Let's talk a little bit about the news that has been bombarding us in the last few days. We had a caller that called in and asked about Georgia Secretary of State Kemp, who came forth within the last week and said that the Democrats hacked the system. Is he right? Is there really some type of election fraud taking place in Georgia?
Well, we assume that there very well may be election fraud occurring in Georgia because the systems are very vulnerable. And, of course, people have that intent where if you let them manipulate an election, they are prone to do so because they just get so excited about their particular position. If you allow them access to the results, they may very well think that it is best for either their own interest or their people's interest to manipulate those results. So we always assume there is a probability that that is occurring in today's world of very vulnerable systems. The specifics of Georgia are, you know, atrocious, obviously, with Kemp playing, wearing both hats, running for governor and being the current Secretary of State. This highlights a lot of issues that are national in scope with the secretaries of state. We need to take a good hard look at, you know, their operations on a state-by-state basis. In Georgia, there's been very many documented incidents. And, of course, their systems are the same systems that we're using in California. There's no difference. In California, we think it's probably a little cleaner game because maybe the people are a little different, but the fact remains we need to set the real precedent in San Francisco for the state of California. It looks like we're doing that. Los Angeles attempted it, but is not really come through like they could have. And so now it's up to San Francisco to really make California the model for proper election systems in the United States. And then we feel like California, in conjunction with New Hampshire, who's already deployed open source election systems at our direction that are operating successfully in the field, between the two states, once we have a good system certified in California, we can link up with New Hampshire and then many other states, including Ohio, Florida, and the big swing states, will come on board.
Ed from Menlo Park, you're on Your Legal Rights. Welcome.
Good evening, gentlemen. I'm a blind voter, and I haven't heard any discussion here about accessibility with regard to these open source systems. And also, then, if you're blind, ultimately, you're not going to really have privacy there, because when you print that ballot, you're not going to be able to look at it and see whether it's got on there, what your selections are in any case. And so ultimately, a sighted person has to look at it, and thus you really never have true privacy if you're blind.
Well, you know, I'm glad to answer that question because obviously it's of the utmost importance. And the good news is that the open source election systems that are deployed in New Hampshire have met with rave reviews from the blind community, as well as the deaf community, the hearing impaired, sight impaired communities, both basically signed off on the system by the playback units that are available. These were all done with open source software. That was probably the most difficult part, is putting together the disability components along with the voter interface. So we're very pleased to say that we are supported by disabilities communities and all the bigger groups attached. And of course, this is a very important part. We have to say that as we move forward and progress with these systems, we always keep the disabilities community in mind. And so I think in the future, as we get more into smartphone voting and concepts like that, the disability community will continue to be pleased with the progress.
Ed, I hope that's been of help to you. Thank you for joining us. And Matt from Berkeley, you're on Your Legal Rights. Welcome.
Thank you. I had a question. Your discussion right now about trying to make an incentive for someone to vote, I remember paying a renter's credit. What if the state of California were to offer a voter's credit and you know, send in, like, I don't know, a photocopy of the tabs they give you, and you get $30 back for voting? Isn't that simple?
Matt, that's an interesting question. The question, and I'll turn this over to you, Brent, the question is whether you think it would be a good idea to have such a simple financial incentive to encourage people to vote.
I'm not opposed to it. I would defer to people that are really smart on that particular issue on how that might work, I have no position on it, and it sounds good to me. Any way you can get people to vote. Again, I think, though, if people have confidence in the system, if they think that their vote is going to be counted as they intended, and you make it convenient for people to vote, I think they will vote and participate, especially the youth we're seeing is incentivized to vote. So as long as we keep it simple and convenient and has that look of honesty and fairness, I think people will vote. And then, of course, we did just mention about smartphone voting, which may be coming in the future with blockchain and open source technology. And then, of course, if we can move forward with, I think there's an act right now, the Election Security Act of 20. It's actually electionact2020.org. That's the movement to not only say that proprietary software should be illegal for voting in California and any other states that adopt that type of an act, but also that we should move forward with smartphone voting and give the kids what they want, the ability to vote on their smartphone.
Matt, thank you for joining us. And Lisa from San Francisco, you're on Your Legal Rights.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to mention something that with all the software we may have, we have to really also deal with the issue on the ground of the voter purges. And the reporting by Greg Palast regarding these purging of voters, Brian Kemp actually purged more like 340,000 voters. There was a 94-year-old elderly black woman who couldn't even vote. Her name was not there, and she'd been voting for the past 30 years. There's been students that were given provisional ballots, and the Secretary of State, his office has just announced him the winner, even though Stacey Abrams hasn't conceded yet. So one thing is the software, but the other thing is what we can do legally on the ground to stop this kind of blatant corruption. So that was mostly my question, dealing with the precedent in the legal issue, not only with the software, but also with this corruption.
And by the corruption, you mean the conflict of interest of...
And also the voter purges that are... Greg Palast has mentioned this in The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, in his documentation of during these past few decades of the Koch brothers funding these cross-check programs, these voter purges, and all that kind of stuff. It basically, even Brian Kemp, when he used his own ID to vote, it said invalid ID because the system, the way the system is set up, is completely wrong. Even his own ID wasn't working.
Lisa, I completely understand your position, and I want to thank you for voicing it. It's a little bit off the topics we've been covering tonight, but you're talking about voter purges and disenfranchisement of a different sort, where you have basically the people controlling the election making an effort that certain groups don't participate in our democracy. And I appreciate you bringing it up. It's a little off the topic we've been talking about tonight. If you want to comment on it briefly, Brent, you may. But
sure. I don't think it's as off topic as Jeff might have stated, only because we break it into two sections, front-end disenfranchisement and back-end disenfranchisement. The front-end is the purging that you're talking about, the disallowance of somebody from voting whatsoever. The back-end would be you allow them to vote and they feel like they've really, really accomplished something by maneuvering through that gauntlet. Now they cast their ballot, but it's not counted as they intended or not counted at all, which is really even more insidious, in my opinion, because when you disallow someone from voting, they know they didn't vote. But when you allow them to vote and then they don't count their vote or count it improperly behind the curtain, they have no idea what just happened to them. So I appreciate your comment, and I think we have to fight on all fronts all the time.
Lisa, thank you for joining us. I couldn't agree with you more. Disenfranchising people from voting is a serious problem. I don't think it's one we have answers to tonight, but I appreciate your sentiment. I don't disagree. We do have a caller that's called in and left us a question rather than wanting to talk themselves on the air. But this caller asked, what difference has open source voting system made? Has it made a difference in uncovering evidence of fraud or hacking? Has it made a difference in election outcomes?
Well, the only place we've successfully deployed an open source system, which is not even a complete open source system, is New Hampshire. In New Hampshire, due to the work of Dr. Juan Gilbert, who is a CAVO board member and the technology professor at University of Florida, he has the voter interface and, as we discussed previous, the disabilities components currently running on open source. But unfortunately, the tabulation process is not running open source software. They're still locked into a Microsoft platform with a vendor code. So we don't know anything more about the tabulation process in New Hampshire than we did before. We might get there, though, soon. We're pushing them very strongly to move their system into completion. But when you have an open source system, you know what's going on. You have the ability to look at the code, and with a current system, you do not. So to answer the question, I think what they might be alluding to is, has there been a smoking gun detected anywhere that has caught fraudsters in the act? The answer is no. It's more of a deterrent, what we're talking about. When you remove the ability to infect a system, or at least create the ability for many eyes on the code to detect intrusion, you naturally have a better environment than the current black box system that is faith-based, and you're just hoping that nothing is going wrong. So the way the scientists put it in layperson's terms, which I appreciate, is either you want to know or you don't want to know. If you don't want to know, keep using private software systems. If you do want to know what's going on, make sure you're using general public license open source in a simple paper ballot system.
5 years ago, Governor Brown signed a bill to facilitate modern voting machines. Didn't that solve the problems here in California?
No, actually, it did not, unfortunately. We keep seeing millions, if not billions, of dollars going somewhere on this issue. Back in 2005, the GAO directed that the National Science Foundation utilize Open Voting Consortium on one of their grant and a group called Verified Voting out of Silicon Valley, David Dill, who's the professor at Stanford, actually put together a group called Accurate. The name was developed by Dr. Rebecca Mercury, who was not given credit for the name, and she was removed from the group as Alan Deckert was not recognized by the group. And that group, the Accurate group, took $7.5 million provided by the National Science Foundation and basically issued a white paper, but it never turned into solution. And so what we see is a lot of money changing hands, a lot of grant monies going toward these groups. Some of them are mentioned in a book I'm reading right now called Winners Take All that talks about how some elite groups are manipulating the grants that are available not only in elections but in other areas, and really doing a disservice to the general community by absorbing the monies without tendering proper results. So we see that in the election reform community, that there's a lot of grant money and a lot of money going different places. In California, the only county that really has stood up and spent their money well is San Francisco. But we're hoping, and we really were very direct in working with California Clean Money, who joined our efforts with the open source community to push the legislature toward funding, doing some matching funds with San Francisco. If anybody is in contact with Phil Ting, I think Phil is really the holder of the purse strings. So we're hoping this next legislative session, if there is money allocated, that it goes for the proper work of assisting San Francisco toward a certified open source voting system, and then that will play to the benefit of the state of California.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. This week, we're talking about voting, voting glitches, monopolies, and open source software with Brent Turner, the secretary of the California Association of Voting Officials. There's still a couple minutes if you wish to call in. Our number here is 415-841-4134, 415-841-4134. If you're not in San Francisco, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. Luis from San Jose, welcome to Your Legal Rights. Luis, are you still on the line? It sounds like we lost Luis. You still have 5 minutes or so if you want to call in. A caller that did call in and couldn't stay on the line remarked that there must be a government office to keep watch on these alternative technologies. Can you identify such an ongoing governmental project in effect?
Unfortunately, as we get into the federal government, we find that there is nobody on duty on this particular issue. We've had extensive conversation with Department of Homeland Security and other folks with acronyms that you would expect would take direct responsibility for a lot of this. And unfortunately, it is left mostly to the states. And then you get into the different personalities of the secretaries of states. Alex Padilla took over after Deborah Bowen, the former Secretary of State. Deborah Bowen was very much a pioneer and an advocate of this work towards open source voting systems. Unfortunately, she did not accomplish her goal and left office with the work undone. Current Secretary of State Padilla promised during his campaign to pay direct attention to this issue. We feel like he did not live up to our expectations. There's still hope for him to rehabilitate, but currently, unfortunately, we haven't received the declaration from him, the push toward the counties that we would appreciate to really expedite this work. And, of course, after 2016, a lot of people got interested, and we're just hoping that the momentum carries through so that the work of San Francisco can can be expedited and we can see a certified system as soon as possible.
In 2014, USA Today featured a story on how digital voting machines were aging out of use. That was 4 years ago. Where are we today? I mean, are we getting close to the point where we can vote electronically from where we are and not have to go to these voting centers?
That would be smartphone voting, and there's a big pushback against that from the same status quo preservationists that really keep the vendors entrenched. So the answer is we see that the machines are aging out, but we don't want to spend – initially we spent $4.5 billion in 2005 on these systems. The next price tag will be approximately $8 billion. We don't want to see that money go toward another round of these same crappy systems. We want to make sure the next time we make an investment, it's in the public interest of the public software, properly architectural, properly architected systems.
Is there any movement anywhere in any of the states to, if we're moving towards voting electronically or voting through smartphones, maybe taking a more activist position and voting on issues and not just voting for those people deciding the issues?
I have seen a lot of that work, and it's happening in other countries, and it's happening on open source platforms, and I think that really is frightful to some of the controlling interests. And so, you know, I applaud that work. That's also highlighted. There's a movie that is coming out, a documentary on this issue. I'll plug it. It's the realactivistmovie.com. And we talk about that issue in the movie as well as some of these other issues that are coming in through the telephone.
And what we're talking about here is slowly transitioning, at least on a local level, from the republic that we've been working with since most of these communities were founded towards a more of a democracy where we're actually voting and participating on particular issues.
Right. No, I appreciate that work. It's you know, we're very simple and singularly focused in that our mission is directly to make sure that when we're using software to count our votes, that software is vetted, secure, benefiting from oversight, and is public, not private behind a veil of corporate copyright or license.
Would you like to take about a minute for any last-minute thoughts?
Well, I want to thank a lot of the people that have been so helpful in this effort. You know, you can take a look at the board at the National Association of Voting Officials. That's navo-us.org. You know, too many to name. Obviously, locally here, starting again with Tom Amiano, Chris Daly, currently, you know, former late mayor. We've got 30 seconds left. So Mayor Lee was advocating with us, the entire Board of Supervisors, past and present, I think, in San Francisco is for this. We just really need everybody to work within their own counties and encourage their own Board of Supervisors and their own elections department to not buy another round of the obviously flawed systems that we use today, to get in touch with San Francisco, reach out to the Elections Commission or the mayor of San Francisco, the head of the Department of Technology, Linda Jarrell, and make your county go toward open source.
You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Our guest tonight has been Brent Turner, Secretary of the California Association of Voting Officials. Thank you for joining us. Next week is a program I've been anxiously awaiting. In May, we featured legal services for children discussing educational rights as amongst the rights your children have at school. Next week, part two, Your Kids Have Rights at School. We look at the police and criminal investigations and school searches. That's next week, Your Kids Have Rights. Again, our thanks to you for listening. Our thanks to our production assistant, Martin McLean, and at the controls, Joanne Marr. I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night. We'll be right back.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.